As the summer supply drops and demand increases, CBCC.US. This is WFAE News.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 65 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Except for a little glitch in recent weeks, the stock market has been roaring. The glitch occurred on a bit of good news from the Fed. The fact that they are predicting an end to historically low interest rates because the economy is improving. Just last Friday, the U.S. Department of Labor announced that 195,000 jobs were created in June, and they revised upwards their numbers for April and May. Home sales here and around the country are on the upswing, and new cars are rolling off the showroom floor. The economy appears to be in a turnaround, and that's what economist Dr. John Connaughton, the keeper of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, predicted for 2013. We've been checking in with him quarterly since the beginning of the Great Recession, and he pays us a visit today to put all of this decent economic news into perspective and probably punch a button or a hole in the balloon. I don't know. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Mike. Thanks.
Let's start with the U.S. Department of Labor's report that in June, 195,000 jobs were created, better than expected. And yet, yesterday in the New York Times, economist Paul Krugman wrote, Friday's employment report wasn't bad, but given how depressed our economy remains, we really should be adding more than 300,000 jobs a month, not fewer than 200,000. Do you agree with that?
Mr. Krugman is a Scrooge and very unhappy. You know, the numbers yesterday were pretty much, I think, what a lot expected. We're running about 200,000 jobs a month, which is close to 2.5 million a year, which is not a bad number. There's a lot of talk, and I'm surprised at Krugman bringing up the 3 million annual number, which is 250,000 jobs a month, because that's the number that Romney brought up. Put it in perspective, Mike. 2012, nobody thought that was a particularly great year, right?
Right.
I mean, everybody's growth was pretty modest in that year. We created about almost 2.2 million jobs in the United States in 2012. Just to put it in perspective, that's the second largest job growth year in the United States since 1999.
Okay.
All right. So that's a span of 14 years, and 13 years, that's the second largest job growth year. And so, you know, this idea of 3 million, the only time that we can find 3 million jobs a year is in 4 or 5 years during the 1990s. When, as everybody understands, that was the go-go decade. I mean, that was basically growth out of control. We had never experienced anything like that before or since, or likely to experience anything like the 1990s in terms of economic growth for quite some time. Those were 4%, 4.5% to 5% years, year after year after year after year after year. And that's not normal or average. So 2.2 million jobs in a year is a pretty good number. If we do that this year, yeah, we'd all love 3 million jobs. We'd all love 4.5% growth. But if we get 3% growth this year and 2.2 to 2.3 million jobs, that's a good number.
The Labor Department also revised, as I said, their figures for April and May upwards.
Yes.
They said that we actually did better than they initially reported. Has North Carolina been the beneficiary of any of those increasing job numbers?
Interesting that you asked that question, because surprisingly, North Carolina last year, 2012, again, not the greatest year from an economic growth standpoint, but from a job standpoint, almost 90,000 jobs, 89,900 jobs. Again, people won't say we should be doing 100,000 jobs a year in terms of growth. 90,000 jobs last year, second largest job growth year since 1998 in the state. So, you know, again, it's a situation where people aren't paying attention to sort of the averages and the numbers that we've had over the last decade and change. And so we got essentially the second largest job growth year since 98. Again, the 100,000 jobs per year only occur in that brief span in the mid-1990s when the economy was really on fire, really going very, very well. For us to create 90,000 jobs is a good number. Now, unfortunately, it didn't do a lot. Our unemployment rate did come down, but it didn't do a lot for changing our position in terms of our unemployment rate nationally in terms of worst states with the highest unemployment rates.
Well, North Carolina started the year with, if I'm correct about this, a 9.5% unemployment rate. That's 2 percentage points higher than the national rate.
Close to it, yes.
But you say you expect an increase of 1.5% this year, or a net of 62,000-plus jobs in 2013. So put that into perspective, because I know we lost a lot of jobs.
And we lost 333,000 jobs. We've gotten about two-thirds of those jobs back. Mm-hmm. If we get the job growth in 2013 and 2014 that we're predicting, we'll be back to where we were when this whole thing started in 2007.
So it'll
not be great. Not great. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say, okay, it took us 7 years to get those jobs back, and say, well, it's okay. But this isn't all. People seem to forget that the economy structure has changed dramatically. Absolutely. And if we look back to the 2001 recession, this is an incredibly mild recession, not anything like the recession we had in 2008 and 2009. Very mild recession 2001. The unemployment rate only got up to about 7.6%, didn't mm-hmm. really spike. But if you'll remember, 2 years after that, we were talking about the jobless recovery. Okay, that even in that mild recession where we didn't have a fractured financial system and we didn't have 8.7 million people lose their jobs or anything like that. We didn't have anything like that. We still weren't able to generate the jobs after the recovery began that we were used to generating back in the 90s when we have a recession in the 80s. And it's because of the structural change. We don't have as many employees per dollar of output as we used to.
Why?
Productivity is increasing, so it's possible. It's possible for firms to, when they see an increase in demand, they can increase their output, not necessarily by have to hiring back every single one of the employees that they laid off. There's been a structural change in the economy in terms of how we make things and how we provide services.
What's causing the rise in productivity? Is it just workers working their little buns off, or is it automation? What is it?
Primarily automation technology, but it is also people working harder. But the major attribute to productivity gains has been technology.
And we in North Carolina have been lagging the national recovery in terms of job growth. Why? We continue to do that. Why?
Just barely. Okay. We're probably, in terms of the percentage of the jobs that we lost that we got back, we're probably a couple, the U.S. got back a little over two-thirds of jobs. We got a little under two-thirds of the jobs back. So it's really two or three percentage points difference in terms of the percentages of jobs gotten back. The reason that our unemployment rate got high and stayed high is not so much what happened since the recession, but what happened during the recession. This recession, if you remember, started before the financial crisis, and it was going to be probably another 2001-1991 recession, probably unemployment rate peak 7.5, something in that range, last for 8-9 months, and off we go again. The problem was that the recession began in early 08, or late 2007, December is what the National Bureau of Economic Research says. And then in the summer, we had the financial meltdown. Mm. That what happened was all of a sudden, a number of banks weren't able to borrow money from other banks to keep their activities going. What they were doing is borrowing short-term to buy long-term assets, the horrible securitized mortgage debt that they owned. So Lehman went out. Then we had Wachovia, WaMugo after that. And we had a financial meltdown. What happens in that situation is that credit becomes unattainable. And so industries that rely on credit, home building and manufacturing, they suffered the big brunt, if you will, in terms of job losses. Almost two-thirds of the jobs, 60-some percent of the jobs statewide and nationally that were lost in manufacturing and construction. We've gained some of those manufacturing jobs back. We still haven't. We're just starting to see some of the construction jobs come online now. That was pretty much universal in the country. On top of that, if you remember, we had a financial catastrophe as well. Because of the high level, the large number of employees, and we had one major bank essentially get bought out, absorbed by Wells Fargo, in North Carolina, because of the large number of employees in the financial sector, we had a hit there as well. So we had a kind of a third shoe, if you will, fall on top of the manufacturing and construction job losses. And so that pushed our unemployment rate up above the national level very quickly, as it had been slightly below that when the recession began. And for the first few months of the recession, it was below the U.S. until we hit the financial. And that's what caused us to go up. While the financial sector is recovering, even though they're making money and their stock prices are going up and profitable, if you look, all the major banks are going through what? A downsizing. They're contracting. Mm-hmm. And so they're not adding jobs the same kind of pace that they were adding jobs in the early 2000s. They're basically, at best, holding and sometimes cutting back the number of jobs. We see these little 500-odd cuts, 300-job cuts from time to time amongst the major banks in Charlotte. So that's part of the reason we haven't seen the financial services industry come back enough to generate the kind of job growth that it was generating earlier in this decade.
So if what you're foreseeing for 2013 and what you're talking about, and this is way out, the 2014, if that continues the way you say it might, we will have gotten back the jobs that we lost in this big recession. So does that mean for us the recession will finally be over, that we're in recovery? Because there's so many other –
well,
I know we're in recovery now, but
– there are two aspects of recovery.
Yeah, okay.
There's a technical aspect of recovery, which actually began in June of 2009. Everybody goes, yeah, sure, right.
Yeah.
And then there's the, I feel like it's a recovery.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what we're seeing now is in the late 2012, but particularly in the first part of this year, people are starting to actually acknowledge and start to feel like it's recovery. The best indicator of that is consumer confidence. That has been in the, you know, that's a monthly survey that's done by the Conference Board, and it has been just devastatingly low for this entire period. And we just can't seem to get out of it. The last couple of months, we've seen incredible jumps in that. It's now up to 81.4, 90's normal.
Mm-hmm.
This jumped up almost 20 points in the last 3 months.
Why?
Because consumers are starting to actually believe that we're in recovery.
Because I'm going to get back to Paul Krugman, your favorite guy.
Yeah.
He said yesterday in the Times that at this rate, full recovery still looks a long way off, and I'm beginning to worry that it may never happen. Later in his column, he writes, someday, I suppose, something will turn up that finally gets us back to full employment, but I can't help recalling that the last time we were in this kind of situation, the thing that eventually turned up was World War II. What is your reaction to that?
I don't think that's actually going to happen this time around.
I mean, we do seem to be on a perpetual war footing. So if
war were the answer to our unemployment problem, then we would have solved it quite a way. But seriously, Mike, I think that
I don't know what that is, but continue.
Yeah, seriously, Mike, I think that Mr. Krugman is still echoing what he felt a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
We would all love to see 3 million jobs a year and 3.5% to 4% growth.
But,
and we may get close to that in 2014. Okay, but this year started off really slow. I mean, if you look at the numbers for the first half of the year, and what we're talking about and what we've been projecting is the early part of 2013, the first quarter, January, February, March, and then second quarter, April, May, June, aren't going to be that great. They're not going to be a whole lot better than they were in 2012, less than 2% growth. And it's primarily because we've had a tax increase, a significant tax increase,
right,
and we've had the sequestration. We've got a cut in the government budgets, and people are getting furloughed, and government's spending less money. And, you know, when they spend money, other people get it, and then they spend it. Despite a significant tax increase for every American,
mm-hmm,
not just the wealthy 1%, but everybody had a significant tax increase. Despite the sequestration, which began in March, the economy has been able to hold on. So what we expect is the second half of the year, it's really going to take off.
Oh, we'll follow up on this.
Okay.
We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's University of Charlotte, where the McCall School of Business offers 4 master's degrees, including an MBA designed for executives. Details will be available at the info session on Thursday, July 18th, queens.edu. edu. Well, the General Assembly has been addressing a number of hot button issues on this legislative session, but one is not getting much attention, and that is the growing number of people living in poverty, a number that exceeds 1.7 million in North Carolina. Charlotte Observer editor or associate editor Fanny Floto wrote a column recently about this and says it's time the state forged a comprehensive poverty plan. She is not alone in that thought, and we've gathered her along with several other people who feel that way to talk about how such a plan might work to combat what is a growing problem. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, filmmaker Josh Fox brought attention to the environmental risks of fracking in his documentary Gasland. He's back with a sequel, warning of even more profound dangers.
Join us for a conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio with Dr. John Connaughton, the director of the Babson Capital Economic North Carolina Economic Forecast from UNC Charlotte, who has good news for the second consecutive quarter, actually. We've had him on the program quarterly since the beginning of the Great Recession, and most of those visits have been doom and gloom, and now he's suddenly back with, I don't know, he's like been to Disney World or something, and I'm not sure how to handle all this. But getting back to Paul Krugman's statement that the last time we had, what was his quote? His quote was, "I can't help recalling that the last time we were in this kind of situation, the thing that eventually turned up was World War II." I think what he's referring to there is World War II was a giant government jobs creation and manufacturing creation program. Because suddenly everybody was producing armaments and tanks and uniforms and airplanes. Is he saying that what we need is this giant surge in government spending?
You know, I'm not ever sure exactly what motivates Mr. Krugman. And certainly, you know, his traditional work in economics that he did as a young social scientist is very, very good work. I mean, he won a Nobel Prize for work on trade stuff. But it's like in his older years, he's decided that markets simply can't work, and that he has a better idea. Okay. And so, you know, I think that's a lot of where he's coming from. And I will say this, and in terms of, you know, I think that in some respects he may be correct that recessions and markets have recessions. Those recessions are extremely painful. Some people get hurt a lot worse than other people get hurt. And I don't think that he likes that. And I think that he'd like to smooth that out. And he thinks that maybe government intervention, government spending, government planning of the economy may in fact do a better job of
cycles
that.
Seem to be part of nature. They show up everywhere. So are cycles really can you really smooth them out?
Well, there are – I mean, certainly the Europeans have tried, but it hasn't – you know, over decades, if you will, in terms of a government playing a bigger role in planning for the economy and ownership of some of the sectors of the economy. but they haven't had any better experience in terms of smoothing those cycles out than a more free market-oriented economy. So,
guys, I read a bunch of articles yesterday, and some people in those articles are asking, will things ever get good again? And I'm wondering if that is because they're longing for those halcyon days prior to the Great Recession when things were artificially inflated. Is that what they mean by good? What is your answer to that question? Will they get good again?
I don't think the 90s were artificially inflated. I mean, I think the 90s were, you know, that's perfect storm kind of thing, a convergence of a number of things coming together at the same time that created a decade of extended stable economic growth without recession, but yet with, you know, 4-5% growth rates and without inflation. You had real change in technology during that period of time. The technology change really came in the 80s, but in the 90s it was absolutely actually able to be applied. We had cheap energy in the 1990s, that's some of the cheapest energy that we have ever had. When you adjust the price of gasoline in the 1990s for inflation, okay, it's actually lower than the 30-cent gasoline that you and I as a kid remember back in the 60s. Yes, really. when you adjust it for inflation in terms of purchasing power, yeah. Yeah, okay. It absolutely is. Well, so you had all of those things going on, and you had Europe coming together and creating, not yet the euro, but on the road to the euro and more unification. So you had a lot of things going on that really generated a tremendous amount of growth for a short period of time. But to back to this, idea of a cycle and how bad things are now. Yeah, they're bad. But believe me, back in the early 1980s, which people don't think about, things were really bad. You're old enough to remember it, Mike.
I remember paying 16% interest on a home loan.
Actually, those home mortgages got up to over 17%. Yeah. So, and the housing industry took a big hammer. At the time, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who was Paul Volcker, of the more recently Volcker rule, was getting 2x4s mailed to him by the construction industry workers. About his interest rate policy. So when you compare Mr. Volcker's interest rate policy in the early 1980s to Mr. Bernanke's, this is certainly a much softer policy and certainly doesn't hurt as many. But one of the things that's interesting is that, and I think what's going to make this really, really different going forward, is one of the reasons that we really haven't had a very solid recovery in the first 4 years of this recovery since June of 2009 is the housing sector was still going down and down and down. It's a big part of the economy.
Right.
And that's changed now. 2013, we've actually seen a change. The housing industry has swung back around. Supplies of new homes are tight. We're down to 4 months of inventory at current sales rates, which is really pretty tight. So that sends a signal to home builders, well, we better increase production to beef up our inventories. Second thing that's gone on, and I know this isn't great news for most people, they wouldn't interpret this as great news, but I interpret it as absolutely phenomenal news. When you look at the Case-Shiller Price Index, it's gone up over the year, April to April, April 2012, 2013. It's gone up by 12%, a little over 12%. When home prices start to go up, that makes a fundamental change in consumer psychology. So for the previous 5 years, when home prices have been going down, consumers sit there and say, well, I don't need to buy a house now because guess what? In 6 months, I'll owe more on it than the damn thing's worth, okay? Right. Now all of a sudden, prices are starting to go up. People are starting to realize that, and they say, well, wait a minute. If I'm going to buy a house, I need to buy it. So it changes the motivation factor of whether or not people are going to buy houses.
So we had another perfect storm. We had falling home prices and incredibly low interest rates on 30-year mortgages for these homes, and people still didn't buy. Now we have rising home prices and rising interest rates, and people are going, maybe I better get on this bandwagon now.
Before it gets out of
worse.
Yeah, before it gets worse or gets – because really, the increase we've seen in home mortgage rates up to 4% from 3.5% in the last few weeks
– not that big a deal.
It's not that big. I mean, it is a big deal. The monthly payment goes up and everything. But it's not going to be – it's not going to make it go up by as much as, the 12% per year increase in home prices. More importantly, when you look at a 4% 30-year fixed rate – or even a 4.5% 30-year fixed rate, you pick out the years in the last 25 or 30 years where it's been that low.
Yeah.
Except for the most recent time, those are historically low 30-year fixed rates.
So this changes these rising home prices changes, as you say, consumer psychology because it makes the recovery actually feel like a recovery. How much will interest rates have to rise to dampen that?
It's a great question. And I don't think that we're going to see a big change. I mean, Bernanke came out and basically kind of took a shot over the bow and said, the economy is improving. We see, the Federal Reserve, we see a good second half of 2013 and maybe even brighter picture in 2014. So what we're doing is sending you a signal because we want to be as transparent as possible. That's the new Fed. 10 years ago, the Fed would have said nothing.
Sat there, nothing.
And now they're saying, and we're telling you that, we had set a target somewhere in the 6.5% range for the unemployment rate, and we're just reminding you of that. And that's all that Bernanke did.
And that caused the stock market to dip for a couple
of
days.
But it's back up to where it was.
Exactly. But why? Why would they – these are professionals, most of them. Why would they react that way?
Well, they're professionals, but, the future is very uncertain. And so all of a sudden, everybody who is, getting ready to take profits – and said, it's time to take some profits. What you have is a lot of big managed funds, and these funds need to generate you know, profits from time to time, where people pull their money out of those funds. And so, you know, when they see this situation where there's a possibility the market might go down very quickly, it behooves them to go ahead and sell, buy back a couple of weeks later. You made a little bit of a profit.
That's right.
And the only person that suffered is the owner of the mutual fund if it is not in a tax-deferred environment, because they will have a cap gain they have to pay.
Getting back to jobs, given that North Carolina has one of the highest unemployment rates in the country still,
yes.
Was it wise for the legislature to cut off unemployment benefits for those who have been on them for, I don't know how many weeks it was, X number of weeks? What's the impact likely to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's certainly something that locally has been a big issue. Kind of put this in perspective, kind of give you some history of this. We have a unemployment insurance program where every time that a worker is paid, the firm makes a contribution to this program.
Right.
Okay? It's called a contribution rate. And it varies by industry and by firm. They're basically actuarially rated based on their experience associated with the cycle, fluctuations, how often they wind up laying people off. And so industries that have much higher levels of layoffs over time wind up with higher contribution rates. Those that tend not to are lower contribution rates. Mm-hmm. The program, as it's set up, was designed to provide 26 weeks of benefits for people who are laid off. So it's a self-insured program. All right, it's not taxpayer money that's effectively paying for people's unemployment insurance. It was the employers who employed people and subsequently would lay them off. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that were essentially funding that program. Historically, when times get tough and there's a lot of layoffs, Congress has allowed states to increase that program to, say, 52 weeks, 1 year from 26, double the period. During this recession, Congress extended it to 99 weeks, essentially 2 years. The problem is that these self-funded insurance programs were never designed to handle four times the length of benefits,
right,
particularly in a period of time when it was difficult for people to get jobs and get off the unemployment rate, get off the unemployment rolls. As a result, North Carolina, the feds allowed you to extend it, but they didn't fund it. So North Carolina wound up going into debt over $2 billion,
okay,
$2.7 billion. That's not money that's collected from the firms that lay these people off. That's money collected from the taxpayers. Okay, that was a debt that we owed the feds, and we pay interest on it, and we've got to pay it back.
Right.
And so what happened is, and what I think people realized, is this can't go on forever. The system, the program, just isn't actuarially sound. It can't make these payments. So what they did was, I think, three things. They cut back the level of benefit. We can talk about that in a minute. That's got some significance as well. Mm-hmm. And they cut back the length of the benefit, and they increased the contribution rate. But nevertheless, taxpayers of the state are still going to have to pony up and pay some of the $2.7 plus billion debt that we've accumulated over these years. So it was kind of a situation that it couldn't go on forever. The money was coming from someplace. And we were going to have to pay for those extended benefits. And as the economy is improving and as we're adding 2.2 million jobs, it doesn't make a lot of sense to continue to support at taxpayer expense the unemployment benefits.
Hal in Peachland has sent us an email. He says it's been reported in the last week that only 47% of American adults hold full-time employment. How can this economy be improving when the nation has 53% of adults either working part-time or unemployed? Generally speaking, part-time employment pays much lower wages per hour than full-time employment. All of this recovery talk sounds like government and media propaganda.
Well, the labor force participation rate is in the low 60s. It's a little lower than it historically has
been. And that
been.
Means what?
Okay, labor force participation rate is the percentage of individuals who are either working, and again, we're not talking full or part-time, and or looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 2 percentage points higher than its typical level. That's troubling without question. But to say that something is fundamentally different right now than it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago in terms of the percentage of workers working percent that are full-time versus part-time, et cetera, et cetera. More people are part-time than full-time right now. Fewer people are working than were working 6 years ago. We're still coming out of this recession. But say that there's something fundamentally different that won't get turned around in 2 or 3 years, that's a little strong at this point.
So are you saying there's no track record to make those statements, or this all this stuff is anecdotal? I've heard a lot of this. My husband used to have a full-time job. Now he has 2 part-time jobs, no benefits, blah, blah, blah.
There is a lot of that, and it's partly due to the fact that recovery hasn't really gotten underway until just recently. What I'm suggesting, folks, is that in the next year and a half to 2 years, we'll get the kind of recovery that we have been anticipating, and a lot of this will change.
So
what happens, Mike? What has to happen is for companies to realize that they can't employ workers part-time, that those workers have full-time opportunities and they'll leave. And so it's essentially, I hate to say it, a supply and demand situation. And when labor markets get tight again, and they will get tight probably within the next 6 months to a year, they'll start to tighten up. Things will change in terms of the way in which people are employed.
So your friend Paul Krugman, once again, gives the Fed credit for ignoring the monetary – what?
Only met him one time, okay? So don't make him my friend.
He gives the Fed credit for ignoring monetary hawks who have wanted to further curtail the scaling back of interest rates for recovery. He says that they've done a good thing by ignoring those people. Have we done things, has the government, either the federal government or the state government, done anything that has hurt or helped the economy in any way?
Well, first of all, I think we can pretty much safely assume that the federal government, Congress and the president, pretty much hasn't done anything since the Stimulus Act of 2009. Mm-hmm. They've been pretty much in gridlock since that period of time.
But all this talk about changing the tax code in North Carolina, et cetera, that puts uncertainty into the marketplace, doesn't it?
Certainly does, but we're not real sure that it's going to be a significantly large change in the tax code when it comes down. But let's go back to who has been trying to stimulate and manage the economy, and that's been the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And because we have an independent Federal Reserve, they have been able to essentially – look at what's going on, make an assessment of what needs to be done, and they've been able to act in a way to do that. Now, I know there are a lot of critics, and I'm sure Ron Paul, as I talk in glorious terms about the Federal Reserve, is probably rolling over and having indigestion right now. But nevertheless, the Federal Reserve has done more in the last, say, 4 years to try to stimulate the economy and keep it afloat than all the rest of the government combined, state and federal government. And I think the Fed, I was highly critical. If you remember the shows we had 4 or 5 years ago when this thing all came down, I was highly critical of the Fed managing the failures in the banking system coming into this thing. I felt like they let things get a little out of hand. They sat back and kind of watched and were not proactive enough in order to prevent companies like Wachovia from going out of business. But I think in the last 4 years, the Fed has done a pretty good job of trying to keep the economy afloat in the absence of any fiscal policy since the stimulus package of 2009. And so I'd give high marks to Bernanke. And I would have to agree essentially with Krugman on that front that he's done a good job keeping the economy from getting worse. Yeah.
And they pretty much use every tool that they have.
And some that they didn't know they had, that they've invented,
Dr. John Connaughton is director of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast. The Q2 forecast for 2013 is out. We're going to talk about some of the positive aspects of that.
Yes.
Look ahead to 2014 when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine. The July issue features the 2013 top doctors list, now on newsstands. Details at charlottemagazine.com. Filmmaker Josh Fox brought attention to the environmental risks of the method of natural gas extraction known as fracking in his 2010 documentary Gasland. He's back with a sequel warning of even more profound dangers, and he's the guest in the 10 o'clock hour of the Diane Rehm Show coming up in about 20 minutes. You can join her conversation, and you can join ours. Good way to get to us is WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Twitter, Facebook, you name it, it's there. We're coming right back.
you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 2 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. John Connaughton with UNC Charlotte, the director of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, the official forecast for the state. It's been gloomy and doomy for quarter after quarter after quarter, and now, beginning at the beginning of this year, things began to turn around. Before we talk about that, let me share with you an email from David who says, your guest is not recognizing the alteration of expected job creation absolute numbers outlined by Mr. Krugman by population growth. Also, the German model for employment after reunification hinged on elimination of unemployment benefits. Do you understand that comment? Because I don't understand.
No, I don't understand that last comment. I think that, you know, but a lot of people look at Germany as kind of the model for
dealing with the economy that we're in?
Yeah, or just dealing with the economy in general. You know, the 20-year experience of Germany since reunification has been an economy that on average has grown at 1.6% in real terms, compared to about 2.5% for our economy over the same period of time. So I wouldn't look at the German model as necessarily the model that I'd want to follow.
Austerity, which they have kind of...
Oh, they bought into that. Yeah,
it's not worked out so well for other non-German nations, though.
Or even for Germany, for that matter. I mean, you know, again, there are 17 Eurozone countries, and they're all still, most of them, in recession at this point in time, and they spent all 2012. They had the dreaded double dip. And, you know, back to Bernanke again. And I'm not trying to raise the Ben Bernanke flag here, although it sounds that way, I guess. But, you know, they went through – you're right, Mike. They went through the austerity program. They decided they were going to get their government budgets in order. And they got the dreaded double dip. Our Fed didn't do that. And of course, we know Congress and the president didn't do anything because they can't do anything. They just can't agree on anything. And we didn't get the double dip. Yeah, we got a slowdown in 2012, but we didn't get the double dip. Our unemployment rate didn't spike back up again. We didn't lose jobs. We still created jobs through that. So, you know, there's kind of – you've got this incredible laboratory experiment. Okay, how does austerity work in the early part of a weak recovery? Not so good compared to the model that we chose to follow. So –
Before I go launch into the predictions you're making here, Melba emails that you are excusing the mean-spirited acts of this legislature to cut off unemployment benefits of the long-term unemployed. You say we have to repay that money now because this can't go on forever. At the same time, you're talking about this very positive outlook on the horizon. Why does North Carolina have to repay the money early at the expense of North Carolinians who are still suffering? That's like forcing your kids to survive on one meal a day to pay off your credit card early. It's wrong.
You know, I'm not saying we have to pay it back now. We've got to stop the debt spiral from increasing. In other words, if you didn't change something, we're not going to pay it back right now. We're not going to pay it back this year. We're going to pay it back over a several-year period. It doesn't get done immediately. Mm-hmm. Okay? But if we continued to give the same level of benefit and continue to give 99 weeks, all right, what would happen is that wouldn't be $2.7 billion. It'd be $3.7 or $4.7 billion, at which point in time we start to look a lot like Illinois. And I don't think any of us want to go in that particular direction where we really start to get to a point where we really got to start cutting back benefits, not just to the unemployed, but across the board. We've got to, you know, stop. We got to cut back in K-12 education. We got to cut back at universities. We got to cut back on social services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, at a certain point in time, you run into a problem.
And in fact, to get back to Melba's example of making your children eat one meal a day because you want to pay off your credit card debt, in fact, that's what people, maybe not to that extreme, but you do have to alter your spending habits and therefore your eating habits if you want to pay off your advance and credit cards.
It's unfortunate, you know, it's an unfortunate cost, if you will, of living beyond your means at some point in time.
So I guess the question is, did they do too much? Could they have altered what they did at the legislative level and achieved some debt reduction?
They could have always done something a little differently. Okay. But I think there were two things going on. And there is some evidence in the literature that talks about unemployment compensation, particularly high levels. And North Carolina had a very high compensation rate. So in other words, the maximum benefit you could get was pretty high relative to a lot of states around here. But it acts as a disincentive for people going back to work. It's what we call a reservation wage. So if you can make $400 a week on unemployment compensation, that kind of sets your reservation wage of what you will take in terms of a job. And I'm not trying to suggest $400 a week is a great weekly salary or anything like that. But you have to understand that you not only get the $400 a week in cash money, you also are eligible for the food stamps and a bunch of other programs, potentially. It depends on your circumstances as to what other programs you are available for, but certainly for food stamps as well. So, you know, when you go back to work and you start earning money, all of a sudden those benefits, you know, go away. So the reservation wage is set pretty high in terms of the type of job that you would be willing to take to get off of the unemployment.
Okay, so last year, North Carolina's economy was relatively flat, and you're predicting modest growth for this year. Is that parallel with what's happening in the rest of the country, or will we still be lagging?
I think it's pretty much parallel. And again, 2013 is a tale of two cities, if you will. The first half of the year is not great. It's kind of a repeat of 2012. Mm-hmm. So it's less than 2%. It's the second half of the year. It started July 1st that we really think things will start to take off. We will have worked our way through sequestration. We'll have worked and gotten used to it. We'll have worked our way through the tax increases that we all suffered.
Is that why you say that 2013 could be a breakout year?
Could be a breakout year. If we start, you know, one of the things that was very disconcerting to me recently is starting to see the construction industry is actually having trouble finding workers.
It's because all the...
Don't go there, Mike.
It's because all the people in the south of the border went home when there were no jobs.
Yeah, mobile labor. But, you know, my point is that there is a supply side kind of a constraint, if you will, in terms of how fast the home building industry can start to ramp up to meet the increasing demand for new homes. if we can overcome that, and I think we will overcome that in a variety of ways, what will happen is that we'll start to see a ramp up in the second half of this year, and it should continue at that pace above 3% for next year.
You talk a lot about GSP and rising GSP and rising GDP and gross domestic product. When those two things start to rise, what impact does that have on the average person, and how does it manifest itself?
Good question. When firms are experiencing growth, I think two things occur. One is, obviously, to support that growth, they've got to hire more workers. So that's number one. And that hiring of more workers then creates a tightness in the labor markets, and that starts bidding wages up. So not only do more people get jobs, okay, when labor markets get tight, wages start to rise at faster rates. And so that's the two ways in which we see that increase in growth can generate a better lifestyle, better living standards for folks. More people have jobs and wages rise.
I don't hear...
We're not there yet.
Okay. Anecdotally, I don't hear as many people talking about the economy as I used to in general conversation. Is that because it's getting better, or is it because we've adjusted to what we now call the new normal? We're not going to complain about the way things are today in comparison to the way they were prior to the recession, because what's the point?
Well, you know, there was a lot of talk about the new normal, and it probably lasted a lot longer than I would have expected it to. But I don't think we're still operating in the new normal, and that is kind of a personal austerity, if you will. Mm-hmm. Everybody behaving individually like the Germans are behaving nationally. Because what we've seen the last several months is actually consumer debt starting to rise again. What we had seen for about 4 years is consumer debt as a percentage of the disposable income dropping as people were essentially learning to live within their means and paying off their credit cards, paying off their debt, making the car go another year or two longer before they bought one, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What we're seeing in the last, say, 4 to 5 months is we're starting to see consumer debt as a percent of disposable income starting to rise now. Mm-hmm. Some indicators of that people can latch onto is I think the consensus out there for 2013 is for car sales in the 15 and a half million range.
Put that, is that good?
Well, that's a really good number. Put that in perspective, 2007, before this all began, we were doing about 17 million cars a year. After the fall, we were down to less than 9 million in 2008. So, 9 million cars. So, you know, when you start, when people buy cars, what do? They borrow money.
Yeah.
For the most part, people borrow money to buy cars. So when we start looking at 15 and a half million cars in terms of sales, it's a good number, not just because it creates car company jobs and sales jobs, et cetera, but it also is an indicator of consumer confidence and consumers' willingness to borrow
money.
And
they're doing it, it seems to me, without offering what they used to do. But prior to the recession, there were all these zero down, 0% financing deals.
There are still some of those out there.
Really?
Yeah, but they probably won't be there 6 months from now. So, you know, consumer note, there are still some companies out there with zero down and 0% financing or 0.9% financing. If you're thinking about buying a car in the next 6 months, it's probably behooves you to get out
to
there and take
now.
A look now, because you're right, Mike. I think that probably within 6 months, if we do get to that 15.5 million sales per year volume, we probably won't be seeing those great numbers anymore.
So for the first time in a very long time, you are forecasting growth in 13 of the state's 15 economic sectors in terms of output, the biggest of which is business and professional services, growing at a rate of 5.8%. What is business and professional services?
What is business?
I want to get into that business.
You want to get into that business. Yeah, interesting. First of all, let me give you some rundown in terms of that's not unusual. That's been the case during most of this alleged recovery, that a couple of sectors have been adding jobs during this. Business professional services is one. Health and education services is another. Mm-hmm. Leisure and hospitality is another. Those have been adding jobs year in and year out, while, you know, manufacturing and construction have been flat, and, you know, durable goods, non-durable goods still been losing jobs. What business professional services are is architects, engineers, management professionals, consulting firms, accountants, you know, the list goes on, lawyers, people that provide professional services to businesses. And one of the things we've been saying about this recovery that's been a little bit disconcerting, and I think Mr. Krugman would agree with this analysis, is that where we lost jobs, okay, over 4 million jobs nationally that we lost were in manufacturing and construction. Those are blue-collar, high school education or less jobs that provide a pathway to the middle class. However, in this recovery where we've been adding jobs is not there, but in business and professional services, health and educational services. And the ability to cross-train from high school education or less jobs to jobs that typically require college education or more, you know, advanced degrees – That's not a transition that's likely to occur. You know, in the past, we've maybe had a year or two of schooling out of whack in terms of where the recovery has been generating jobs versus where they got lost. And now we're, you know, 4 or 5 years of higher education difference between the sectors that are gaining jobs and the sectors that lost jobs during the recovery, during the recession. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most troubling thing of all of this. And extended unemployment benefits, all these programs aren't going to bridge that gap. That is a tough gap.
So what you're saying is where the jobs are growing is in the jobs that require higher education.
So
if
so
you were
far,
one of those
yes.
line workers who lost their job and you had a high school education or maybe 2-year degree, those jobs aren't coming back.
Those jobs aren't coming back. Let's back off of that for a second. We've seen some manufacturing jobs coming back. We've heard the term, U.S. manufacturing renaissance.
Right.
And this has been unusual. 5 years ago, I would have bet that we wouldn't have seen this. But we're starting to see some U.S. manufacturing jobs come back, not replacing the 2 million we lost. We probably gained 500,000, so we got maybe 25% of the manufacturing jobs that we've lost back. Is this going to continue, and for how long? It's anybody's guess. But there are a number of factors that have led to that. Secondly, what we haven't seen and what we are likely to see going forward is that the 2 million construction jobs that we lost, We haven't gained any of those back yet. And now we're going to start to see some of those come back. And my bet is that we got a better shot at getting at least half or three quarters of those construction jobs back over the next several years than we do in terms of getting the manufacturing jobs back.
So given what happened with the stock market, when the Fed just reminded people that that when unemployment or employment gets to a certain point, they're going to start raising interest rates again, and the stock market went crazy, what will happen when they actually do what they say they're going to do?
It's a good question, and it depends a lot on what the economic growth is at the time they do this. If we just make the trigger, okay, we're at 6.5%, we're going to start to pull back and get Fed out of financing long-term debt and some of the short-term debt that they've been buying up, then, you know, obviously you're going to see the interest rates rise. And that would obviously change the mix of money in the market versus the mix, you know, in equities versus the amount of money in fixed instruments, debt instruments. And so you'll see a pulling of money out of the market. However, and this is the big however, if the economy is clicking along at 3.5% growth at the same time, those equities are still going to look pretty good. So actually you won't see as much come out of equities and go into fixed. You'll see some new money show up,
so
maybe from out of the country potentially.
If you have a 401k, what would you be doing now to prepare for that?
I make no predictions about this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is
– So on the whole, are you an optimist or a pessimist with the national economy and with the state economy?
I'm pretty much an optimist at this point in time. I think that the next 18 months are going to be pretty good. I don't really see you never know. And there are certainly external factors that could cause problems.
Egypt, the Eurozone.
The Eurozone is what it is.
Okay.
And it's just kind of a slow-growing economy. It's probably not going to change very much. If anything, they may actually do a little bit of stimulus. I mean, they have been lowering rates a little bit there. But, you know, the Egypt is the wild card. But assuming the Suez